This is a recording of the audit hearing held by the Federal Election Commission on February 15, 2012. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
We're here today to have a hearing with the National Right to Life Political Action Committee, and Mr. Bopp is here to represent the committee. Mr. Bopp and I just discussed the fact that he has 20 minutes to give a statement about the matter, and he has said that he prefers to have 10 minutes on the front end and 10 minutes on the back end. And as you know, different commissioners have the opportunity to ask you questions, and so does the staff. So we'll get started, Mr. Bopp, with your opening statement, and again, you've requested 10 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. There are three issues that we have raised regarding the audit. We think some of the matters need to be placed in context, and once we do that, you will see that in some instances there were very simple mistakes that unfortunately. Regarding the first item, the reporting of independent expenditures ended up in a big number of over-reporting of $1.5 million in independent expenditures. But it was based on one simple mistake. So the one thing we want to do is place things into context. The other is that we believe that we are being the audit is criticizing us for not having certain documentation that is not required by law, and that there would be no reason for us to think that we should have it. So we want to explain those instances as well and put those into context. First, with respect to the reporting of independent expenditures, as you all, it is the practice of National Right to Life PAC, and they did so during this election cycle of 2007 and 2008, to make an advance of a large amount of money to a printing company, EU, in this case, of $1.5 million. And then that advance is then charged against for doing specific independent expenditures that would occur right before the election, within 30 days or so of the election. Now, the law requires with respect to this is that the initial advance for printing to EU, that's Envelopes Unlimited, a vendor that does our printing and mailing, that advance be reported as on the line regarding operating expenditures. Then, when you actually do the independent expenditure, and as long as it's within the required time frame for either a 48-hour or 24-hour report, of course you file an individual report on that particular expenditure, and when it becomes clear what we're going to do, when we're going to do it, and we prepare the material for the independent expenditure. Of course, the independent expenditure is made. Usually a postcard is dropped in the mail, and at that point a report is due, and we report now usually, because it's mailing, an estimated amount for the independent expenditure, because we don't usually know the number of pieces that will actually be mailed and the postage that it would be associated with it. So the cost can vary, so it's usually an estimate. And then, of course, the third time that independent expenditure would be reported would be on the next periodic report. And, of course, by then we would normally know the precise cost of that particular expenditure, because by then we would have received an invoice from EU specifying how many were mailed and the associated expenses. Now, the problem here was that with the advance of $1.5 million that was reported as an operating expense when the next periodic report was prepared. Of course, we would be reporting the individual independent expenditures on the line for independent expenditures, not operating expenses. Now, Aristotle does the periodic reports while we do the 24-hour and 48-hour reports in-house. And Aristotle, when they produced the draft of the next periodic report, of course, they noticed, and that might be either the post-election or the year-end, depending upon for certain expenditures or others. And they saw that we were in negative territory, that we were going to be reporting a negative amount of cash on hand, which is, of course, not right, could not be. And Aristotle, once when they discovered this problem, did not know a solution other than for us to ensure that we had correctly entered our independent expenditures in our computer for their purposes of preparing the reports. And, of course, we did do that verification to ensure that it was correctly entered. And not having a solution, we went ahead and filed the report with a negative cash balance, and then but continued to try to figure out what the problem was. Well, there was a change in the program which allowed our people at NRLC to have more details regarding the periodic reports that were being filed, and one of them, you know, the light went off, and that is that we had made the advance to EU and that advance had never been charged against. So they then began to prepare an amendment that would charge each of these independent expenditures against the advance, thereby reducing that total. So we're filing, you know, negative numbers that would reduce that total, and then it would be the problem would be rectified, and the correct amounts with respect to these transactions would be properly reported. The new program made it easier to spot this error. However, it made it harder to file an amendment, and we tried to file an amendment. The computer would not do it because of certain problems, and that's when we got notification of the audit. So the amendment was not filed until after notification of the audit, but we had discovered the root of the problem and were in the process of correcting it when the audit occurred. So that's all to say there was one error. That error was when we were reporting the independent expenditures on the periodic reports. We should have also been charging that against the advance that we had made to EU, and that would have rectified this $1,500,000 over-reporting of our independent expenditures. The second is with respect to the reporting of employer and occupation of our contributors. And the question is, complied with the regulations required best efforts to accumulate this information? Of course, we ask for the information three times. This was initially provided to the auditors in the committee background and internal controls document, the report, series of questions that were asked about certain information by the auditors. And Attachment A explains that on the solicitation, the mailing solicitation or the phone calls, we asked for employer and occupation information on the initial solicitation. We then, after people's gifts are entered, we periodically search for all of those entries that are blank with respect to occupations and employers. We generate from that a a list. That list is merged with a computer letter, and then we send out a letter to ask for the employer and occupation information. And we do that a second time, that same thing a second time, if the information is not provided. We know that the first one went out and from our own internal records because the computer record for the donor, we put a memo entry requested, which is how we indicate in the computer that we have made that first letter request, not the solicitation, that's always happens, but the first letter request for the information. Now, when the audit occurred, we had over 1,000 donors who had not been reported with respect to their occupation and employer. About 700 of the we had responses from donors, about 700 donors of the information. And, of course, we had a documentation of that, which was this letter. This is the letter that is sent out to the donors. When they come back, they are filled out at the bottom with the information that we are requesting. And then this is then put into the computer, and then when we file our reports, of course, the information is in the computer to report the information. So this letter without the filling in is the letter that the computer generates from the list of people who have not produced the employer and occupation information as we originally requested in our solicitation. What we're being criticized for is that we don't have blank copies of these. In other words, we didn't go to the copy machine and copy all of the outgoing letters. And now, of course, to more than half of them, we've got it because they sent it back. But for those that didn't send it back, we don't have the letter. Well, we know and through the computer record that it was sent because it's a computer record that says requested. So we know the first letter was for sure sent. And as to those that responded, we have the actual copy of the letter. There's nothing in the law that I can find that that would require us to keep copies of the letters that we sent when we already have ample verification that this actually was done but through a computer record, and we have, of course, many copies of the letter, which is a standard letter that is generated for every at every request. The third item is with respect to our broadcast ads. During this period of time, we had ads run on about 800 stations in the United States through about 500 contracts with broadcast stations. And of course, we keep records of all of those transactions in order to properly process payment within the organization. So we always have what's called an insertion order. It is really the contract with the station, which reflects the order that we have made for the broadcast advertising and when they're going to run the broadcast advertising. And of course, it's signed by NRLC and by the whoever's contracting for the station, usually the station itself, as this one is. Then we also have a check request, because you have to pay in advance for broadcast advertising. So as a result of this contract, we generate a check request, which contains all the information, and of course then a check goes out. Now the stations, because the Federal Election Commission requires it, will produce a third document That document is an affidavit that after the broadcast ads have actually been run, it's their affidavit that verifies the what broadcast ads were actually run when and where when they were run, and of course we also so in our files we would by the conclusion of the audit it was 83% of the buys we would have the we had the affidavit. Most stations send this to us as a matter of course. Some stations send it to the media vendor that is our agent for contracting with these. Some stations won't send it at all. The FCC only requires them to have it on record at the station, and there is no requirement anywhere that I can find that the Federal Election Commission requires the PAC to have a copy of the affidavit. This is this is a combination which is typical of the invoice reflecting now the final and exact total of what we owe the station, and then if it's less than what we paid them originally, they generate a refund. If it's more, we send them a check, and it also includes the affidavit part, which verifies the dates and times that the advertisement was actually run. In this case, it's a four-page document, and then the final document is the script of the advertising. So, what we are being, and as I mentioned, by the end of the audit, we had 83% of these affidavits that they requested. At the beginning of the audit, we did not have that many because one of the media consultants that was placing the buy for us had received the affidavits but had not forwarded them to us. So we asked them for them. They sent it to us. And so at that point, we had 83% of the affidavits. And, of course, here's the folders that all this information was contained in for this period of time. The result was 17% of the time we did not have the affidavits, and we are being faulted for that. And our point is that the law doesn't require, we've never been advised, we've been audited before where our broadcast advertising has been reviewed for to verify that it occurred and it cost what we said it cost and all. And, of course, at that time, we didn't have affidavits in a number of these files. The FEC auditors didn't tell us that was required at that time. There's no reason for us to know that additional item of documentation was required to be in our files. But we are being faulted for that. Those are the three issues that I wanted to present to the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Bopp. Any commissioners have questions? Commissioner McGann.
Best efforts. So you produced to the auditors those letters?
Mr. We produced to the auditors copies of the, 700 or so that we had that had been returned.
Okay.
What we didn't have was copies of the ones that we had sent but not returned.
Well, that's you don't have to keep those.
Hmm?
There's no requirement that you keep copies of the actual letters, so that you've given more than you need. Now, did you have a sample of the letter?
Yes, this is the letter.
Which is more than a sample. It is the letter.
Yeah,
just making sure I'm on the same page.
Yeah.
All right. So your solicitations had the required fine print. You sent a follow-up letter.
And then we sent another follow-up letter. This same letter goes out again.
Just for fun, even though the reg doesn't require you to incur that cost of postage. But yet the draft here says NLR PAC did not document best efforts to obtain, maintain, and submit information for most of these contributions. What am I missing?
It's my understanding for the 708 contributions, we did not have an indication that best efforts was recorded, meaning we didn't have a letter, nor did we have any indication as far as like in a log or like I think you had mentioned that the Aristotle system kept track of the code.
Or this way, Tom. Oh. But they don't need to keep an actual letter. The log is when it's an oral phone call, which maybe they did, but they also sent the letter twice. This is deja vu all over again. You don't have to keep the letter. A sample sufficient. Do we change this? Am I?
No, nothing is.
Nothing's changed, right?
No.
But what I'm hearing is it sounds like they satisfied best efforts. Why don't you guys think he satisfied best efforts? Because they're not the actual letters that were sent. Maybe Mr. Favin can shed some light on this, since Mr. Hintermeister pivoted and looked at Mr. Favin.
I think the problem that we had was that we weren't informed that this information was in the database, and so we weren't aware of that. So we really were under the impression that these were not sent.
I was shown the pile of 700 of these letters that are dated when they went out, to whom they went out to. And of course, they're tailor-made in a couple places because they say how much the contribution was. So I saw the 700 that we had and produced to you all during the audit.
So we agree they were produced?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So we've all seen this pile of 700 letters. What's missing?
I'm sorry?
I'm still lost here. What's the database reference?
From what I understand, that there were there were 708 for which there wasn't a letter, nor could we see in the database to verify that a letter was actually sent. So for 336, we had the letter, and they actually had the information, but it just didn't make it to the reports.
Okay. Which is a different issue than whether the letter was sent. But the database doesn't have to know, they don't have to note a letter was sent in each case. The reg doesn't require that, right? And not only does the reg not require that, we've had a number of audits the commission's had over the years before I got here and since I've been here where the established best efforts does not require some proof that they sent a letter to each and every person. It's more of the response device says the right thing. Mm-hmm. They say they sent a letter and they have a copy of something that has the right language. It seems like they have plenty of copies of what was actually sent. Are we saying that they maybe sent them to 708 people but didn't send them to other people?
Well, I think that's what we were looking to verify for the 708.
But the rule doesn't require that level of verification. You know, I feel like we're punishing this committee for having more records than the reg requires, so now we want them to have even more records. It doesn't make sense to me. But we do have the letters, right? There's no miscommunication on the facts here.
Yes, okay. There were 952 letters, I believe, actually.
Okay. And the 708 was what were not there.
Exactly.
But the reg doesn't require them to have copies of those letters.
We also explained the procedure, you know, the in writing to the auditors what our procedure is. So,
is there any issue there? The procedure that they described in writing is somehow wrong?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
It's not hard. You just copy, grab an RFAI that has it in there. You just copy it, and that, you know, they put that on your response device. And right. I mean, he certainly orally has articulated above and beyond the proper procedure. All right. If I could, a question about the material misstatement finding. So I... As I understand it, everything was reported. Certain things were, I guess the argument is double reported, because you reported, make sure I get the facts right, you reported the IE spending before dissemination on the regular report, like you're supposed to do. You showed it on the IE report, which you're supposed to do. But then after that, you're supposed to... Is it due an amendment? How does this? I'm a little lost because in the draft audit report, it doesn't cite any law for the discussion of what the committee should have done or not done. And it's a little confusing because if you read on page 5 and 6, the first full sentence, NLRPAC should have reported these advance payments on Schedule B, Line 21B as operating expenditures. Once the committee distributed the printed materials, it should have subtracted the amount of these expenditures from Line 21B and reported them as independent expenditures on Schedule E. And then it says they did correctly report them on Line 21B when the payments were made and then correctly disclosed them as IEs on Schedule E. They just didn't do the math. The first sentence I read is confusing because it sounds like they should have done something, meaning report on Schedule B, Line 21B, and I read it thinking they didn't do that, but now that I read the full paragraph, they did it. They should have did it, and they actually did it. So not just they should have done it, they actually did do it, right?
Correct. Okay. Yeah, the only question was that it was on there twice.
Okay. Mechanically, how do they, when's the appropriate time to do this subtraction, and how does that get reported? Is that an amendment, or is that the next regularly due report? Is there a time limit on this, and is there any sort of regulatory authority that either speaks to the requirement itself or the timing?
Well, I would think it's once it's identified. I think you had mentioned that you noted right prior to the audit that you identified the error that occurred. I think it's from that point forward that once you identify the error that the reporting is required.
Yeah, and at that point we were working on an amendment.
And you've done the amendments?
Huh?
The amendments have been filed?
Yeah, they're filed in response.
So the public record's correct. Now, second question on timing. Given that they disclosed the payment on their regularly filed reports and their IE reports, this was all disclosed before the election. This subtraction, would that be due on a report before the election, or is that something that happened after the election? Or who knows? It depends on each case.
Sorry. As the expenditures are made, they should be, or as the independent expenditures are made and reported on Schedule E, they should be removed from the advance on Schedule B.
Means an amendment is due?
No amendment. As the reports are made, for example, let's say they made the advance in the August monthly. But so you have, $1 million on the August monthly. Then when the September monthly comes in, they've spent $500,000 of that. They then subtract $500,000 from Schedule B and then add that $500,000 to Schedule E.
So they're essentially moving it from one line to the other?
Yes.
That's what this is about. Okay. That's what I thought. I wanted to make sure there wasn't more to it than that. That's all I had for now. I have other questions, but I think Commissioner Peterson wants to ask something on the same line. I would continue, so I'd yield back.
Okay. Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you began to address this in your opening comments, Mr. Bopp, but something that stood out to me when reviewing the materials dealt with the scope limitation issue that you addressed, and quoting directly from the material that you submitted, you say the scope limitation in the report is incorrect. Invoices and broadcast station affidavits for the expenditures in question were provided to the audit staff for review. In the limitation section of the draft final audit report, it says in maintaining its disbursement records, NRLPAC satisfied the minimum record-keeping requirements of 11 CFR 102.9. However, external documentation such as invoices and broadcast station affidavits were not available for review. So there were and
83% were available by the end of the audit.
Okay.
The affidavit.
You said there were fewer at the beginning,
yes.
But were there some at the beginning?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Just, if I can just turn to the eye, how do we kind of explain the, I mean, we're saying polar opposite things here.
Yeah, I think we do need to make clarification in the scope limitation as it's stated here to indicate that some of the records were available during the audit. I think that was just an oversight on our part.
Okay. And if Mr. Bopp is correct that 83% of the affidavits were available, was that still not, from the perspective of the auditors, not sufficient to be able to make the determinations regarding, as it says here, debts and obligations paid in a timely manner and should have been reported as debts and so forth?
That's correct, but sometimes the affidavits didn't have enough information, or the documentation that went with them didn't have enough information for us to verify the dissemination dates. And so what we're doing with the scope limitation is we're not necessarily faulting the committee for not meeting the requirements of the regulation for record keeping. What we're saying is what we had wasn't enough for us to complete our testing, and that we were unable to verify the dates that needed to be verified that were on the notices.
Okay. And that, which gets us into the larger question of what's required under the regulations versus what's the lingo that you use, generally accepted auditing practices or what have you, that there are standards for audits that are kind of the standards that are used by auditors across the spectrum but aren't necessarily captured by our regulations. And it sounds like there can be a disconnect between our regs and what are considered generally understood auditing practices.
I suppose there's maybe a bit of a disconnect, but really what we're just trying to say here is we have a certain list of tests and reviews that we normally do on an audit, and sometimes we're not able to complete those reviews because the information that we need, you know, is either not provided to us or is not available on the information that is provided to us. So as an auditor, you know, it's our obligation to state when we're not able to complete a review that we would normally complete on an audit.
Okay.
And I think that's all we're really saying with a scope limitation.
Okay. But it sounds like there's no disagreement amongst anybody that the information that there was nothing that they should have had that they didn't provide, that there weren't any records that were required under the regulations.
According
that they should
to
have
the
provided.
Regulations 102.9, absolutely. And if there had been, we would have written a record keeping finding.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Walther.
Thank you. To that point, what I guess what you're saying is that one reg doesn't require it because it wasn't specific enough, or the information that you needed, and so therefore you felt you needed to limit the scope. I mean, I'm just trying to understand what you did and why.
Right. 102.9 essentially requires an invoice or a canceled check, whereas it doesn't get into the detail of what would be required to substantiate, like, date of dissemination, for example, for an independent expenditure.
But Regulation 104.14, does that come into play here?
It's a very interesting question. Maybe legal counsel would weigh in on that. Historically, it has not. We typically use 102.9 as our standard for whether or not record keeping has been complied with.
So does that regulation basically off the books in a case like this?
I really don't know the history behind. From what I understand, there is not much in the E&J as far as how this has been interpreted in the past. But
where is it not clear where it says each political committee or other person required to file any report or statement under the subchapter shall maintain all records as follows? Then it goes down and says, maintain records, including bank records, with respect to the matters required to be reported, including vouchers, worksheets, receipts, bills, and accounts, which shall provide in sufficient detail the necessary information and data from which the filed reports and statements may be verified, explained, clarified, and checked for accuracy and completeness. Now, granted, there's another regulation there, but that doesn't mean that this one doesn't. Do you think it meant to supersede this in its entirety?
I think in the past it's been looked at that record keeping is 102.9, and what is in 104.14 is more of the record, is more of the reporting standards. I understand that it does have what looks to be record keeping language in it.
So this doesn't count anymore for record keeping? I mean, I'm just trying to understand.
It's not something that we have pursued in the past.
That's all I have.
Commissioner McGann?
Let me get Mr. Bopp's view on this. Because I'm reading this Reg 104.14, which is a kind of a general record keeping. And it says each political committee or other person required to file any report or statement under the subchapter shall maintain all records as follows. And the subchapter expressly includes independent expenditures. And as Commissioner Walter indicated, it says maintain records, including bank records with respect to the matters required to be reported, including vouchers, worksheets, receipts, bills, and accounts, which shall provide in sufficient detail the necessary information and data from which the filed reports or statements may be verified, explained, clarified, and checked for accuracy and completeness. Did you keep bank records?
Sure,
right? The issue here is not whether you kept bank records and worksheets. It's the dissemination date, which is not going to be on a bank record or worksheet accompanying bank records or those sorts of documents. I don't read the reg as requiring a committee to create new documents to prove up dissemination date when we know they made an IE, we know it was reported, we know it was paid for. We already covered this. It was reported twice in a matter of speaking. So it's dissemination date. So I'm not sure that that's writing the reg off the books. I think it's talking about something that's not really at issue before us, but that's for the next meeting, I guess, when we describe the audit on. But I just want to make sure you were keeping the records that I think are covered by that reg, which is bank records and worksheets and invoices and that kind of thing. So, and if you don't have the invoices, I don't think you're required to pull them out of whole cloth. I mean, I understand your presentation on the media buying. It's not easy all the time to get all the documents. Sometimes the media buyer has them, sometimes stations don't give them to you, but it seems like you have a remarkable amount of information, more than I thought you would have. 83% for a bunch of IE buys is quite a bit. So, sounds good to me. But I have a question for the auditors. Following up on Commissioner Peterson's questions, the draft audit report, the limitations paragraph, says this. In maintaining its disbursement records, NLRPAC satisfied the minimum record-keeping requirements of 11 CFR 102.9, period. However, external documentation, such as invoices and broadcast station affidavits, were not available for review in order to determine whether or not debts and obligations were paid in a timely manner or should have been reported as debts. The audit staff needed to see dated invoices. The invoice dates would indicate when the debt was incurred, et cetera, et cetera. I don't understand this, because the first sentence says they satisfied the minimum record-keeping reporting requirements, but then there's this however that essentially says there's more documents they should have had. Either they've satisfied the record-keeping requirements or they haven't. It gets into how much more documents would they then need. This feels like the Missouri Democratic Party audit all over again. At least we're not saying the ads were somehow illegal, but it seems like, to me, you're on the one hand saying he had the minimum amount of records, but on the other hand, the committee, not Mr. Bob personally, the committee had the minimum amount of records required, but then, well, there's this other external stuff. Now, I understand you may want to, as auditors, say there's things you didn't. Well, see, every auditor puts limitations on every audit. I understand that, because there's always variables somewhere that auditors like to protect themselves from. But here, you're saying they kept the records, but then there's other records. I don't understand the conflict here. I can't rectify the two thoughts or make them consistent.
Well, really, all they're required to have for disbursements is a canceled check and, let's say, a computer entry with the name and address and the purpose for the disbursement. What we're saying here, let's take debts, for example. We haven't mentioned that yet. But without an invoice, we can't tell whether a debt was required to be reported or not.
Is there any issue here with debts? Do you have any information in the course of this audit that they didn't report debts?
Well, debts is part of the scope limitation as well, for the same reason as the independent expenditure for dissemination dates, is that we weren't always able to tell when a debt was incurred, so we were unable to fully test debts like we normally would.
Okay.
Because they didn't have all the invoices that we needed. But
well,
they met the minimum.
Hold on. Hold on. It's not that they didn't have all the invoices that were needed under the regs. They didn't have all the invoices that you as an auditor would like to see to avoid the limitation.
To complete the debt review.
Right.
And therefore it results in us having to put a limitation on our scope, saying that we weren't able to test debts like we normally would. As an auditor, we need to make that announcement here.
But it's weird, because if the reg doesn't require them to keep those documents, how do you get to say that the audit finding is therefore limited? I mean, we're doing an FEC audit here. We're not doing a general audit that doesn't have a legal framework attached to it.
Well, I think that's what Commissioner Peterson was saying, in that, you know, as auditors, we have certain responsibilities and obligations when we do our audits. One is, if we're unable to complete a test that's part of our normal procedure, we have to explain that and we have to state that. And you're right, it's not required in the regulations for them to have that information per se, but we also can't complete our test because they don't have it. We would encourage them to have it.
So the absence of documentation that shows they don't have debt means you have to have a limitation that says they might have debt, but we're just not sure because we don't have documentation disproving. That's kind of the proven the negative. Yeah. And I understand from an auditor point of view, auditors do this in the abstract, but in this case, I'm just not following the need for a limitation on documents that I'm just not following. Because I still see it as inconsistent that they maintain records, but, well, if they had more records, we wouldn't have to limit.
Right. If they had all the invoices, you know, maybe not all of them, but, 80 or 90% of the ones that we needed.
Okay.
I think we had about maybe 50 or 60 for the debt review.
Percentage-wise.
50-60%.
And you didn't have any issue. You didn't see any debt issues based upon what you reviewed?
Well, there were some issues,
okay,
but we didn't have enough to write a finding on it.
Okay.
Because we didn't have enough of the invoices to conclusively say that overall they had a material finding for this area.
Okay. On the IE side, not the debt side, but the IE side, they had 83%, according to Mr. Bopp, they had 83% of their documents finally. You know, it took a while to get it because of the stations and whatnot. I understand all that. Is there anything in their material or otherwise where a dissemination date you thought was wrong based upon their review of their reports?
There was, my understanding is that there was a lot of difficulty vouching or comparing some of the dates from document to document that came from some of the vendors. In other words, it was very difficult for us to say, yeah, that's the date for that one, because some of the information wasn't there. So it wasn't a question of whether they provided the 83% of the information to us. It was, we were still unable to conclusively verify.
I understand you think that's the question, but that's not answering my question. You turned it into, well, use the word vouching, like they have to vouch. What I'm asking is, of the information that they have from themselves, because they did it on their own, their media buyer, TV stations, either directly or via by way of the media buyer, where their own documents say, hypothetically, an ad it was disseminated on October 3rd, and their report says it was disseminated on October 4th or October 2nd. Do you have any indication that the reports were wrong on dissemination dates?
There were some that were wrong, yes.
How wrong? And how do you know they were wrong?
Well, sometimes we actually had the information that had the dissemination date, and it was off by a couple days from what was reported on the notices. And we're talking about 24 and 48-hour notices.
I understand.
Right.
I understand. Is that because the documentation was fuzzy, or it was tough to read or it's actually wrong? Because when you read some of this documentation, it's not easy to piece it together because station affidavit is done after the fact and all that. I mean, if you're looking at the date of the affidavit, that's always going to be off. I'm just trying to figure out, is there a reason to think of the remaining, you have 83% in the door, right? Of the remaining percentage, is there a reason to think that there's some problem with those that would result in some sort of materiality problem, that there was, that there's a real issue here? Because it seems to me there's not. It seems to me that we have a large universe, and there doesn't seem to be any material problems. So I'm not sure why we need the limitation when you have 83%. You see what I'm saying?
No, I understand what you're saying exactly. I hate to keep going back to, you know, the auditor response to this, but, you know, we were unable to verify, you know, half or a little more than half of the dates on the notices, even though it's possible, you know, 83% of the information was provided to us. If we had been able to verify it and we found out there was a big error problem, we would have written a finding on this.
Right.
But the fact that...
Okay, so the bottom line, right, you would, if there was a problem, you would have written a finding.
Absolutely.
Okay, so you didn't see a problem. So that's why we're talking about the limitation. And what I'm still trying to figure out, limitation-wise, why we need to limit it. Because you don't have 100% of the IE. What specifically are you missing? You know they paid. It's a dissemination date, right? So you need 100% of dissemination date to not have the limitation?
It's not 100%, but it's...
Well, they had 83, so we're, you know, we'll pick a number between 83 and 100.
Well, within our program, we do have numbers and percentages.
Okay. All right. What else could they have given you? Is there some sort of substitute documents? I mean, Mr. Bob's explained it's tough to sometimes get this stuff from stations because they don't turn it over. What could they have done, even though I don't think the regs require them to do it, but just for fun, let's say they wanted to go out and, like they did with Best Efforts, and do extra stuff. What else could they have done to prove up dissemination date?
I mean, obviously, an external documentation outside of the committee is usually better. But, you know, if there was an indication where the committee called the vendor or to see when the dissemination was and keep a log, that would have been something that could have been taken into consideration.
Right. Anything realistic, though? I mean... I mean, I guess you tell your media vendor to change traffic or put up an ad, and the media vendor sends it to the station. Media vendors tend to keep that, and I think we have. Do we have that sort of information here? I think we do. I mean, that seems to be some of the things he was holding up. But at a certain point, you may not have that because some of that's on the station to confirm or whatnot, and sometimes they got to, you know, they change traffic, and the station actually sort of sends it back to you, maybe, if you're lucky. Sometimes it's on the phone, even though there should be a written traffic change. I'm asking, what else could they do other than keeping a log, which that's nice, but that's not required?
Well, I guess it could also be asked, then why would we ask committees to report it? Dissemination.
What's that? Sorry?
Why do we ask committees to report dissemination if we're not going to have them have a record of when it was disseminated?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to sort of get into why the legislation says what it says, but you report dissemination date because that's when the ad goes public, and that was in a rulemaking years ago. The statute was construed that way. But... you know, the ad goes up. The people who see the ad know it's up, and they know the dissemination date because it's on TV. The question is, can we years later put that together? Is really more what you're asking. Now, if you want to say we don't have to do IE reports, we can work together on that maybe. But I don't think that's what you're saying. I think you're coming from the report, from the record keeping side.
Exactly.
Okay.
And we're just looking as auditors to verify the data dissemination. And in this case, we couldn't put together the information. We couldn't from the records that were available, find that information.
Mr. Bob, can I ask you a question, factual question? Of the that beyond the 83%, is it a complete absence of documentation, or is there some documentation, aside from the IE report, that indicates the ad was aired and whatnot?
Yes. Can I distribute my exemplar here to you all?
Maybe up to the chair, if that's...
Absolutely.
The two things we have in every case is the contract, which is the first page. This is when the station is contracting. This is the contract. They sign it, as you can see to the lower right-hand side, KNZZAM is signing this on October the 8th. And this is the schedule that they are agreeing to run the advertising. Beginning October 8th, and how frequently and in what programs. So you always have this, because you have very, and then how much, if they ran it like this, how much it would cost. Now, the second thing we have, so this is an agreement. Now, we do understand that occasionally people make mistakes, they forget, or they double book, or, you know, they make mistakes. But, you know, it seems to me this is doggone reliable information on when these ads are going to be placed. The next page is our check request form, where we put the dissemination date up on the upper right hand. You see October the 28th, that's when these ads were to begin, how much they cost, and what, you know, they're all about for reporting purposes, the presidential, Senate, party, GOP, et cetera. Independent expenditure, et cetera. So it's based upon that, this second document we call a check request, that the check is generated or authorized to be paid. Now, the next page.
Before you move to that, can I jump in and ask you a question?
So we have both of these.
For everything?
Yes.
Is that provided to you guys?
For everything? Let's clarify that. I don't. For 83% or for?
For everything. Internally, we require that you have a contract and a check request in order to generate a check. We don't generate checks without a check request. So you don't get, the affidavit is generated after the election.
And that's where we're probably getting into the 83%, because you don't have all affidavits from stations.
Right.
That's a station.
We had 83% of the affidavits. And if the next page is the fax transmittal sheet, but then the next page says invoice at the top from KNZZ. This is their combination invoice telling us now exactly what we owe them, even though we paid them. You know, if they didn't run it for some reason the way they agreed, they could owe us or we could owe them. Usually they owe us because they failed to. And then their affidavit is the information below, which is exactly what day, time, et cetera, that these ads ran. So we have both their, so beforehand we have their agreement to run at on specific dates and times, and this tells us the when they were actually run, and this is a four-page document in this case. And then the last page is a copy of the script. In every case you have an affidavit, you have exactly the dissemination date. This is the station swearing under penalties of perjury for the FCC that they actually did this. So there wouldn't be any of the 83% that you wouldn't have ex post facto exact designation of when these occurred. Now, we understand the audit, because we do a full audit, okay, every year. You, in doing the audit, you do samples. You don't look at, 800 of these, even though we had them available. You take a sampling, and looking at your sampling to determine whether, in terms of your initial examination, whether there's any reason to go farther than the sampling. Well, 83% surely is enough to do a sampling. So I just don't understand how one could say we don't have a dissemination date when you have it ahead of time and you have it afterwards. We don't contract to run an ad and then they just decide that they're going to run it March 13th.
Right. They don't know.
They tell us exactly when they're going to run it ahead of time.
So I'm straight. The first couple pages, which are National Right to Life PAC documents,
You think
you have those for all IEs?
I think we have those for all IEs.
It's kind of a log in a way, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was just talking with Cam, and I think some of the problem was we couldn't match up what was on the affidavits to what is on the second sheet there. So,
well, that's different than what we've been talking about, though. Matching up is not the same as not having documents. Do we agree that you have the right to life check request with the date of dissemination? Now, maybe they're lying to themselves, and they actually are tricking up their own dissemination dates to get checks. Maybe they have an internal issue, and there's some, something going on there. But let's assume none of that conspiracy theory works, and let's assume that they're actually cutting a check for this dissemination date. You have these documents.
Right. Apparently, in some cases, the dissemination date was not available on this second sheet.
Sometimes the dissemination dates were not on there, but that was rare. Mostly, the ones that I could verify, they did not always match the dissemination date on here.
What you're saying is when they cut the check, okay, all right, I understand, I think. When you got the check request and you cut the check, you anticipated it to be date X, and by the time they decided to give the check to the station, maybe there wasn't as much inventory available. Mm-hmm. Maybe they had to move it back or up a day.
Could happen.
And what you don't have is the subsequent traffic change or affidavit back from the station confirming. Yeah. So it's not that the dissemination dates, you don't have evidence that the report date is wrong. You have evidence that says, well, it doesn't necessarily match their own internal check request, which doesn't always match what happens once you get the check to the station.
They don't always,
always
run it the way they agreed to.
Right.
Because they can make mistakes, they can forget, they can have conflicts, they can have sold. So there are things that happen where they end up not running it in exactly the same day, the same order, et cetera. But that's, pretty rare. These are people who are in the business to make money, and they make money by selling advertising. They promise, they've contracted with us to do it. So it's pretty rare.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you. I'd like to return to best efforts on the itemized contributions. So we can be clear, while the reg doesn't specifically state what type of documentation a committee has to have, it does state that it's up to the committee to show best efforts. And if a committee does show best efforts, then it will be deemed in compliance with the Act. And so what I'm trying to understand is what the auditors were shown to be able to verify whether best efforts were met. And, of course, the reporting issue is secondary. And as noted in this draft final audit report, that you have made amendments that have materially corrected this issue. But I want to go back to something you said about you have a database that shows for individual contributors that letters were sent. Was that provided? Did the auditors have access to that? Were they able to see that so they could?
What I understand is the procedure was explained to them, that the record was explained to them, but they never asked to see it. They took our word for it. That's what I was just told. That is in the record, but they didn't ask to see it.
I mean, the database is something we asked for right up front in the first audit notification letter. I mean, it's pretty standard procedure. That's, you know, pretty...
I was just told this particular thing was not asked for. That's the reason it was not provided. That's all I can say.
Well, I guess as I read the interim, it asks for documentation about best efforts. Obviously, you're asserting that this is part of your evidence of best efforts. So, I would have assumed in response to at least the interim and all of the conversations you've been having with the auditors about this that these notations, or I can't remember exactly how you described it, but if it's a sophisticated sort of mail merge kind of system, it can track when they go out, and if that's what you have, that would have probably been very useful for auditors to be able to see, because of course the different committees do things differently, and the regs don't say you have to call every single person. They don't say that gives options to committees, which I think is important, but it does put the burden on the committee of demonstrating those best efforts. And of course some contributors may refuse to give you that information, and that's why there is this opportunity to provide to show that you have done that. I think that database probably would have been that portion of the database might have been useful, Mr.
And we would be happy at this point to show it to them. It has a memo entry that says requested, and of course what they also received was a description of our procedure, which I talked about at the beginning. And what they also received was, 800 or 900 of these, which were the responses of letter. So obviously we're sending them out. If people are sending, 800 or 900 people are sending them back to us. And our procedure is to do it for everyone that we don't have the information. Then that procedure was provided in writing. So if 900 people sent these back, and we say we sent it to everyone, and 700 didn't, I think that's the figures. What's the question?
Well, I think
we're just making this up. We didn't send it to those other 400 or 500 people.
I don't think anyone's suggesting someone's made it up, but certainly different committees use different procedures.
Sure.
You might send them out in batches, and one might have been missed. If some person were doing them, it has to be within 30 days. So if somebody were doing it every 2 weeks and somebody was sick the day they were supposed to go out, I mean, it's so you can certainly see why verification is required. Mr. Hindermeister, I think you had something to add.
Yeah, I just wanted to note that on the interim audit report and the recommendation there, it clearly states that it was requested that the committee provide documentation that it exercised its best efforts, as well as amend reports.
Thank you. Commissioner McGann?
Right, but... that's standard language where you always ask for information that establishes best efforts, and that's always been, at least always in the relative time frame, been a sample of the response device, a sample of the follow-up letter, right?
Right.
Not a database and all this other stuff. I mean, that's well and good. Maybe there's a miscommunication here on the database issue, but at the end of the day, they don't have to track it in a database. So when you ask for best efforts, and Mr. Bopp's telling you, well, we gave you a response device and we gave you a bunch of letters. And the way I read the reg, and there's really only one way to read the reg because it's what it says, that satisfies best efforts. I mean, I feel like we've been around this ring before on this three-card money with documents.
It's obtain, maintain, submit. That's the way it's been for years. And, we're just trying to verify that those best efforts were in fact.
But what I understand we are being criticized for is that we don't have copies of every letter we sent out.
Which the reg doesn't require. Am I wrong on that? No. That this is deja vu all over again. We've already had this discussion a number of times. Other audits.
We did that earlier.
So
it's just this database. Who has this? Do you have this database? Or is they, do they still have the database?
We received a database request.
This will be our contributor database. I'm sure we have it.
But yeah, we do have it. We do have a database.
So
whether that information is there or not, I
we don't know, because he didn't tell you it was there when he asked for best efforts. So who knows if it's there? So we may actually, all this may be a great intellectual discussion. We may actually have a database that shows these letters were sent to everybody that needed to get a letter. Even though the reg doesn't require all that, we don't know. But the good news is at least we have the information at the Federal Election Commission we can check.
If we don't have it, Mr. Bob said he'd give it to us.
Right.
Sure.
Commissioner Bowerly?
Thanks. This may be an issue of miscommunication, but I just think it's, from my perspective, the reg says it's up to the committee to show it. And so if you have the information, it's incumbent upon the committee to provide it to us. So
they have the database. They just said they have the database. It has the memo entry.
And it seems to me that it, since it's your database, and if that it says requested, it might. I don't know that we would necessarily want the auditors to start assuming what certain notation in your database might mean. I think you can see where you might take issue with that in certain circumstances. So, I think it, you know, when asked for best efforts, that is, you know, would that because the reg is. Permit some flexibility, but the burden is upon the committee to show it. So I think it's incumbent upon the committee, particularly when being asked to what that looks like, help the auditors see where that is. Because again, I think you would probably not want them making assumptions about particular notations in your database.
Sure, but I think all of that is superfluous. I mean, what we have demonstrated is of the 1,400, whatever the number was. Of ones without occupation identification, we gave 800 or 900 that were returned, and we say that we sent them out to all of these people. As a matter of course, that's our procedure. Every couple of weeks, we do this, and I don't think we have to keep copies of all the other letters that we sent out in order to demonstrate that we are fulfilling. And these have dates on them, so you can see when these are sent out. So you can go through the 800 or 900, whatever it was that we gave you, and you can see the dates that these went out. So you can reconstruct it from this if you wish.
Could I get clarification on the database? Do you know if you said it was coded if a letter was sent to the contributor? Is that a separate column or a separate field, or are we talking the occupation name of employer field that was filled out, information requested?
Initial name. And we see that it's blank. We fill in that area as requested.
Okay, where is it in the?
In the organizational name.
Organizational
there isn't one yet. We haven't got heard back from them. So it goes and requested us organizational name. That's what those who sent the letter. They never asked to see that particular thing.
Yes.
But that's what they'll see in the database.
Okay. Now I've got the clear picture. Sorry. In the computer record for the contributor, there is a field for occupation and employer, right? When we get the contribution first, if that information is not provided, when we enter the name, that those fields are blank. So when we do the search, we ask for the contributors that are blank in the occupation and in employer. So we then get a list of those that are blank. We then do a merge, generate these letters. But then we type into the occupation
organizational name,
we type in requested. So that's how you know, because when we send out the letter the first time, we type in requested.
I think that might, I don't know if that was fully explained to the auditors during field work. We can certainly go back to the database and take a look. And Yeah, I mean, I just don't understand, to a certain extent, why this information wasn't brought up in response to the interim report.
If you look at the exit conference outline, which is would be a confidential document, but you would have it, we have a printout of the we have a printout. It's how many pages? 20 pages of donors. And of course, this is confidential because we got donor names and donor addresses here. But if you look to the right under occupation, you see the printout says in many of these here in this particular printout, information requested. That's how we know that we sent the letter.
And Mr. Bopp, you provided that at the exit conference.
Yeah, that's in fact attached to the exit conference itself of June 10th, 2010. And there is the list and of our donors, not all of them, I'm quite sure. And I don't know what the search field was for this, but it shows people that have occupations, and it's listed there. But the vast majority of them, of this printout, is information requested, and that means the letter was sent.
Is that the information we gave you at the exit conference, or is this something you provided to us?
I don't know, because I haven't inquired. What I know is it's attached to your report, so I don't know if you generated it. Well, obviously, I don't know what.
Well, yeah, we provide committees a listing of all the errors or exceptions that we've identified during the field, and that's probably the work paper that demonstrates that.
Okay. And what you now know is that in the field called occupation, if it says there are some that are blank, it means that they are recent contributors where a letter hadn't been sent out yet. Many others have, from your, whatever, how you've selected these people, under occupation, it says information requested. That's not automatic. That is entered when we send out the letter. So every one of those that say information requested, we have sent a letter to.
And in the 10 days after receiving that, did you provide anything to the auditors? And in the interim report, after the interim report, did you provide anything to the auditors?
I don't know. I don't know what further discussion.
I think all you did is amended your reports. Schedule A.
I don't know what the further discussion. This all boiled down to we don't have a copy of the letters that we sent out. I don't know how you decide to get to that point in this, but that's been the bone of contention, that we didn't have copies of letters that we sent out that were not returned. That's it.
Commissioner Walther?
Just as a matter of, didn't we cover the issue of, this is off the track a little bit, but the availability of canceled checks, and then concluded that canceled checks weren't required as long as the bank had them, we could get them from the bank. In other words, the point being, if the records are there, just not in physical custody, that's good enough for audit purposes as long as verification can be made fairly regularly. Is that?
Yeah, we have.
It seemed to me we covered that point some time ago, but I don't remember the case. But it seems to me it's somewhat akin here, where records are there, but they may not be physically right there to make them available, but they are verifiable. I guess that's the issue. Somehow. I'm wondering if maybe at this point, we've worked this through quite a bit, whether we should ask the audit staff to take a second look at the information and to come back with their memorandum or something like that.
Any other questions? Mr. Hintermeister, do you have any questions?
No, I just would offer up that if there is any further documentation the committee can provide, is that something the commission wants to do, or is that something I would do in response to today's?
I think certainly, you know, people are always willing to amend the record. I don't know that there's anything that you would need that you haven't already been provided. But if there is something, maybe it would be helpful to tell Mr. Bopp now. I don't want to leave the onus on him to send anything else back in if he doesn't even know what it is that you need.
Okay. I mean, we'll be in contact, but if the database, for whatever reason, is different than the one that Mr. Bopps has in possession right now, that could be something that could...
So the ball is not in Mr. Bopps' court. It's in our court to let him know if we need anything else, any other additional information.
Yes.
Okay. Counsel, do you have any questions?
No, Madam Chair. We have no questions.
Okay. My understanding of the next step, you know, the audit division may have additional questions, Mr. Bopp. And then the next thing that usually happens in our process is the audit division circulates another version of the DFAR, the draft final audit report, with a memo attached to sort of describe what happened here at the open meeting, I mean at the audit hearing, sorry. And it's possible that the audit division may change the draft final audit report. So they certainly don't have to, but that is possible. Do you have any closing remarks, Mr. Bopp?
No, thank you very much for your time and attention. Appreciate
thank
it.
You for coming in. We really appreciate it. The hearing is adjourned.